Okay, so Neil and I hopefully worked this out. I don't know if I'm am I in the speaker screen now? Because I'm seeing Fred. Ah, look at that. All right. What I want everybody to understand tonight is I am going to be sharing some fairly complicated ideas, but I don't want you to, one, tune out, and two, get frustrated, because basically the way to approach what I'm going to be sharing, okay, is that it's like a puzzle, and it's a fairly simple puzzle, and when we put the puzzle pieces together, we get a picture that is ultimately going to show how genetics, this is a field of study, genetics is confirming the biblical account of not only the creation of Adam and Eve, we're going to be talking specifically about people to begin with, humans, but also what we would expect to see genetically in the world as a result of the flood. So we're not talking about, you know, looking at the layers of the earth. We're not talking about looking at mountains and things like that, which you might think that's what you would study if you're looking for evidence for the flood. We're actually going to be looking at the DNA inside of our bodies and inside the bodies of other organisms. And it also confirms what we would expect if the Bible were true. And near the end of what I'm going to be sharing, you're going to find that it's amazing how precisely the evidence points to the flood, so specifically that the scientists that were doing the research, because they weren't creationists, were having to say, oh no, but we don't believe in the flood. That's how precisely the evidence points to the flood. So if you don't understand everything, that's okay. I'm going to try to give you analogies that'll be simple to understand. And by the time we're halfway through, hopefully you're going to be a mitochondrial DNA expert, okay? Or at least you'll be able to say it. So I got to get my screen up here. And I do this. You're going to see everything in here for a second, but then hopefully you'll just see the there. Okay. Somebody give me a thumbs up. Do you see the title screen there? Can somebody give me a thumbs up? Good. Okay, great. So my ministry, Scripture on Creation, I'm on Facebook. I have a website and I have a radio program that you can listen to by going to the website, or if you understand how podcasts work. So that's enough of the commercial. We're going to study is the genetics of Genesis. And, you know, there's really nothing about genetics specifically in Genesis. And yet there's a lot of information there that relates to what we are learning in the field of genetics. As I already mentioned, geneticists are producing data. And right now, because of the new techniques that we have, you know, for example, think how quickly now they have moved from discovering this COVID-19 to developing a vaccine. Now, we haven't completely yet, but I mean, it used to be years and years. But now we can very, very quickly determine the molecular structure of, for example, a virus or the DNA in some organism. So we're rapidly producing mountains of data, especially in the fields of genetics. And what's happening is the discoveries that are being made are, one, confirming Genesis, and actually, two, confounding the evolutionists. So I want to start by talking about the search that took place for Eve. I mean, they literally, now pretty much everything I'm going to be sharing is the results of research by evolutionists. This isn't, some of it is by creationists, but most of it is just in the field of genetics, in the academia, and you know, most of those people are evolutionists. So they were saying it tongue in cheek, so to speak, but they really were looking for one woman And so they called her Eve because they believed that the entire modern human race would have all descended from one woman. And there was a way that they could try and check this out. So over 30 years ago, geneticists from Berkeley, which is where I happened to go to school. Now, this was after my time. I graduated from Cal in 1976. But in 1988, geneticists at Berkeley produced some genetic research that really shook the foundations of human evolution studies. When you think of human evolution studies, you probably think of, you know, they're looking at bones of apes and cavemen and things like that. Well, that's all they did up until the mid 80s. And then they began to try to do this kind of research a different way. From their research, what happened was the mindset of thinking that modern man was about 2 million years old. And so, in other words, on Earth, 2 million years ago, there were some creatures that were fairly pretty close to modern man today. 2 million years ago changed to 200,000 years. In other words, it came down by a factor of 10 where they felt like, well, modern man's first ancestors only go back 200,000 years. Now, for us, that's still a long period of time. But to the evolutionists back then, you know, this was a pretty dramatic change. And the reason that they made this change was because instead of looking at fossils, they started using DNA. And by comparing the DNA of different organisms instead of comparing the fossils of different organisms, they were able to get a much more accurate picture of how organisms were related to one another. The piece of DNA that they were studying wasn't the whole piece of DNA in your body. You know, every one of your cells has all the information to make you. You know, they could clone you if we had the capability, and if God allows, and let's hope God doesn't allow us to clone humans, but they could take one cell, get the DNA from that cell, and make you physically. But the structure that they were studying for this research was just a little piece of DNA, and it comes from a little structure in the cell called a mitochondrion. What is mitochondrial DNA? Well, it's small, so it's easier to study, and it's passed on only by the mother, theoretically. So it's not something where mom and dad, you know, their DNA joins, and then you make a new organism. The mitochondrial DNA is just passed on to the baby from the mother. Little piece of DNA only comes from the mother. And of course, when you're just comparing the genetics of a piece of DNA, it's much more objective than comparing fossils where, well, I think that this bump here is significant. I mean, you're just comparing the letters of a message, literally, from one piece of DNA to another. I can't really get any feedback from you, so I can't ask you how many of you know what a mitochondria or have ever heard of a mitochondria, but it's a tiny little thing inside your cells. And this is a picture of it. And it's got its own little piece of DNA to help itself replicate. It can't do it completely by itself. It has to use the apparatus in the cell as well. But some of its information to make itself is carried on its own little unique piece of DNA. So that's what this mitochondrial DNA is. And I may just start calling it mDNA. All right, that's this little piece of mitochondrial DNA. There it is. There's the mitochondria. It's the organ that the little organelle that actually produces the energy for your cells to carry out the biochemical reactions. So these are the little powerhouses in your cells, and it's got its own little piece of DNA. So there's a graph of what DNA might look like, and there's a logic that we're going to go through, because if you understand this, then you're going to understand why they were using this little piece of DNA to look for Eve, literally look for Eve. All modern humans, and so here's the logic that they use. These are the assumptions. All modern humans have a common mother. Well, that's true, isn't it? I mean, we know it's from the biblical account. It's her name is Eve, but they were just thinking that this was some ape-like woman, but modern enough to call a modern human that lived somewhere. They all think that she lived in Africa. Who knows where today is, where, you know, the Garden of Eden is today. I frankly think it's completely gone. I don't think there's anything left of it because the whole world was flooded, so it would have destroyed it. The mitochondrial DNA of her offspring will be exactly the same. Everybody has the same piece of DNA from Eve until mutations start occurring. Mutations are simply corruptions of the information inside that piece of DNA. So everybody, every generation would have identical mDNA until somebody, let's say 10 generations later, somebody had a little change in that mitochondrial DNA. Then that woman would be passing on that change to her children, and those kids' cousins would not have the same mitochondrial DNA, right? Because she wasn't the mother. They were the children of her sister, all right? Over time, more mutations occur in the mDNA. And so over time, lineages from Eve will be accumulating greater numbers of differences. So let's say generation after generation occurs and one line has a mutation and the other doesn't. And then a whole bunch of more generations occur and that generation that didn't have any mutations gets one. Now, there are two differences because the first line has its own unique change and the other line has its own unique change. So there are two differences now. And those just keep accumulating generation after generation. The average time it takes for a mutation to occur can be determined. And I'm not going to try to explain how that is, but we can estimate how long it takes for, on average, for a mutation to pop up in a lineage. If you can assign a time value to a mutation, I'm just going to make up a number. Let's say about every thousand years, really it's every so many generations, but every thousand years you would expect to see a mutation. Then you can assign a time value to the number of mutations you see that you count in the mDNA. You count the number of mutations, you multiply that by the period of time that it takes for a mutation to occur. The number of mutations that are different between one lineage and another will be then a time value instead of just a number value of, oh, there's 20 mutations here. If it's, let's say a mutation equals 1,000 years and there's 20 differences, how many thousands of years would they say those lineages had separated from each other? 20,000, okay? What they then determined they could do is if they could figure out how many mutations occurred between all the different races, between all the different lineages on Earth, they could count backwards and figure out how long ago we all had the exact same mDNA that we got from Eve. So that's the logic, that's the rationale. The principle is really about the same as the game telephone. You ever play telephone? You know, where you come up with a sentence? DNA is just like a sentence. It's a bunch of letters that give instructions. So you've got this sentence and you tell the person next to you, you whisper it, and then they tell it to the next person. And what happens when you pass the sentence on, say, through 10 people? Sometimes it's amazing how different it is by the time you're done with the line, right? Have y'all played that game? Anybody ever play telephone? You did it in youth group and stuff like that. So it's like you're accumulating mutations. The information is getting corrupted, right? Every time you pass it on, there's a chance that it'll corrupt. That's what's happening in DNA. The more times the original message gets passed from one person to the next, the more the original message changes. In other words, it mutates. That's what DNA does. So what these scientists did, instead of looking at fossils, is they determined, we can tell that there's on average one mutation every 600 generations. They then looked at Asian people and Black people and Irish people. They looked at all the different races and they were comparing the mDNA from all these different races to see how many differences there were between them. When they came up with a number, they found out that, wow, if one mutation equals 600 generations, when we add up all of these differences between all the different races and go backwards, everybody had the same mother, Eve. Everybody had the same mother only 150,000 years ago. At first, they said about 200,000. And then doing a little more research, they actually narrowed it down even more to 150,000 years. Now, again, for us, believing in a flood, we would say, well, no, wait a minute, the flood, you know, that's too long ago. The flood didn't happen 150,000 years ago, or Adam and Eve didn't happen 150,000 years ago. And I would agree with that. The reason they come up with that number of 150,000 years is because they were using an important assumption, an evolutionary assumption that, frankly, we don't need to accept and shouldn't accept. But as an evolutionist, they're going to accept this assumption. And this is it. How could they have assigned a value to a mutation and say every mutation equals 600 generations? Here's how they did it. They assumed, they knew that humans and chimpanzees evolved from each other. In other words, there was this ape-like creature that split into what became chimpanzees and humans. And they assumed that they were quite certain that happened 5 million years ago. So then they took all the differences in the mDNA between chimps and humans as an average, came up with that number of mutations, divided that into 5 million years, and that's how they came up with, okay, it's so many generations before for every human mDNA mutation. So that's the assumption. Humans and chimps had a common ancestor 5 million years ago. If that's wrong, then these calculations that they did to come up with 150,000 years for Eve to have existed are going to be wrong as well. So it's sort of like turning the mitochondrial DNA into a clock. And up to the point of 1988 and a few years beyond, their mitochondrial clock said one mutation occurred every 600 generations. Thing is, if you can see the date on this paper, 10 years later, in the late 1990s, they did some other experiments, and without going into a lot of explanation, they found out that actually the mitochondrial DNA mutates a lot faster than one every 600 generations. And they did this because they didn't have to rely on the assumption that chimps and chimpanzees had a common ancestor 5 million years ago. They did it by digging up some people's remains that were many, 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 many generations past, with a person that they knew was alive today, and they determined exactly how long it takes for a mutation to occur in mitochondrial DNA. So it wasn't assuming anything anymore. They knew that this person was this many generations removed from the person that was alive today. And then they got an actual empirical number based on real research, not based on evolutionary assumptions. And when they did it that way, they found out that the mitochondrial DNA mutated much more rapidly. Here's a little quote from this paper. The observed mutation rate reported here is very high or fast compared to inferred rates from evolutionary studies. So they're admitting that the new numbers are measured, observed, where the old numbers were just assumed. They were just inferred. They talk about an old study where they had the old rate of one every 600 generations. An evolutionary study yielding one of the faster estimates gave the mutation rate of one every 600 generations. Thus, our observation is roughly 20-fold higher than would be predicted from evolutionary analyses. What's that mean? Actually, mitochondrial DNA mutates once every 30 generations. That's what we actually observe, not assume by using humans and chimps. So one every 30 generations is the actual number. So here's what they say. Our empirical rate, in other words, what they actually were able to measure, to calibrate the mDNA clock would result in an age for modern man's last common ancestor, or Eve, of only 6,500 years. That's the number that actual measurements come up with. Now, I think you can see there's a comma after the word years. Can you see that? Because he didn't even finish the sentence. Clearly incompatible with the known age of modern humans. Oh, okay. So what we know is what we infer. We don't accept what we can actually measure. That's what the evolutionist must do. Another researcher responded to these new results and said that no one thinks that's the case. This was published in Science, which is a very, very prestigious evolutionary-oriented journal. She said, no one thinks that's the case. Well, you know what? There are quite a number of people who do believe that that's the case, that our modern female ancestor to the entire human race lived 6,500 years or so ago. So empirically speaking, our best estimates are 6,500 years ago, modern man's last common ancestor, Eve, lived and began passing her mitochondrial DNA on to all her descendants. A number of years later, because they were trying to figure out, hey, you know, there must be some mistake. What can we do to change this? They were doing this kind of research, and they really were not able to find any answer. So they were trying to explain the difference between evolutionary and empirical studies in these mDNA clocks that they were using. And the quote from this paper was, there's no evidence that any one factor explains the discrepancy. Possibilities are, and then they list these things that are all genetic jargon. But the last one is very interesting. They say, or the limitations of evolutionary approaches. Yeah, there's a big limitation to that approach, because if you're dead wrong in your assumption that humans and chimps evolved from each other, evolved from a common ancestor 5 million years ago, then your numbers are all going to be wrong. Here's another very fascinating fact from these mitochondrial DNA studies. This is published in Anthropological Review. Again, it's a evolutionary publication. Here's a quote. I'll quote it in a moment. This is the results of this article that they did this research in. Though the time frame and area from which humans dispersed in this study that I'm going to quote from is different. Now, the ways they say from Africa, and we don't know. Yeah. Fred, did you want to say something? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. They're saying it's from Africa, and their time frame is different because, again, they're based on this evolutionary assumption. Even the evolutionary studies determined that all the mitochondrial DNA that are in all humans in all different races can be boiled down to three major mDNA lineages, three major ones. That's similar to, we've got three main races, right? Caucasian, Negroid, and Asian. But it's really not those three that these mitochondrial lineages come from, but three major lines of mitochondrial DNA exist in the modern human race. Now think about it a minute. Can you come up with why that would be? Where does the mitochondrial DNA come from? It comes from the woman. Why wouldn't it just be one? I mean, we all came from Eve, right? Well, it doesn't come from Noah's three sons. It comes from Noah's three daughters-in-law. By the time the flood came, those three women would have had changes in their mitochondrial DNA and been somewhat different. And then the entire human race all stemmed then from those three women, giving us three major mitochondrial lineages. So that is exactly what we would expect, given one, Eve being the mother of all humanity, and two, those three women being, again, the three mothers of the rest of all the human race. So once again, this is what genetics have determined. The best estimate is modern man is 6,500 years old, and Noah's three daughters-in-law are the basis for three major mitochondrial DNA lineages found throughout the modern human race. Now, I heard one of our sisters say, "Oh, where's my Bible?" I'm sorry, we haven't been looking a lot at the Bible, but let's do remember what it says in Genesis to see where these three lineages came from, all right? Then God spoke to Noah saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and your wives, sons, wives with you." Now, very specifically, so there's these three women that were on the ark, and then, of course, there was Noah and his wife. He says, "Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds, animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So the Bible is telling us that at the point of the flood being gone over and the animals and the people getting off of the ark, you're starting out with three childbearing women and then pairs of all the animals, the land animals that were on the ark. And what we're going to find is there is astounding confirmation of the animals all starting at a common point, which we would expect as a result of the ark as well. This is brand new research. This was published not 2 years ago. Mitochondrial DNA research, and it has really rocked the evolutionary scientific community. This is just a headline from the Daily News published in the UK. "All humans may be descended from just two people," and that's not new. We've known that for a couple decades. But it goes on to say, "And a catastrophic event also wiped out all species 100,000 years ago, study suggests." This again is using this mitochondrial DNA. And remember, that's 100,000 years is using that assumption with the chimps and the humans. So we're not accepting that. They're ignoring the research that was done with where we actually knew what we were dealing with, and we found out that modern man is only 6,500 years old. Comparative studies now use a specific little piece of mDNA. Doesn't matter what the name of it is, but they call it a barcode. Have you ever wondered, you know, when you buy apples and there's that little code on there, and maybe you buy some Granny Smith and you buy some Golden Delicious, and all you do is swipe that on the scanner and the thing knows the difference. It's because of that barcode, right? Or whether it's broccoli or whether it's a TV dinner, there's information in that little barcode. Well, what these scientists have determined is there is a section of mDNA, and it's virtually like a barcode that can determine what species you're looking at. So you don't even have to look at the entire mDNA now. You look at this one little section of the mDNA, and they can determine that, oh, this is a red fox, or oh, this is a Indian elephant. It's that specific, just a little barcode. So they compared these barcodes from the DNA of all the different species that they could get a hold of to determine how long ago within these specific species. So within the Indian elephants, within the red foxes, within humans, they had a common ancestor. In other words, they all started that particular species. Research published in 2018 using these barcodes indicated that not only did all humans have a recent common ancestor, but 90% of all species of animals can trace their ancestry to recent parents at a common point in history. In other words, most modern species, all at the same point in time, have had a restart resulting in the repopulation of the Earth, which is exactly what we would expect from the flood. So here's a little graph, maybe it'll help. So I just picked a few different species: elephants, human, raven, gorilla, lion, alligator. But and it's going up the graph is time. Okay, so down at some point in history there was a global catastrophe wiping virtually everything out. Then through time, that pair of lions and that pair of elephants started reproducing. The females of that particular species, as they passed on their mitochondrial DNA, were producing different lineages, and those mitochondrial DNAs would be mutating, right? So they did the same thing, the same kind of study with all the different species now as they did with humans. And when they did that, and they traced these mutations back in time, they came up with all of these different species all started at the same point in history, and again, a very short period of time ago. So they used genetic barcodes, and they studied 5 million specimens. 5 million. You know, they weren't just looking at a couple of animals. They studied 5 million, looking at 100,000 different species. What the research demonstrated again was that humans and animals sprang from a single pair of their own particular species. This may have happened after a catastrophic event. They say after the last ice age. I'm just quoting what they put in their research results. And then, of course, the study has been misunderstood by some religious parties who interpreted it as challenging evolution theory, which has been denied by the authors. This is the paper, the main paper that published these results of the 5 million species and so on and so forth. And what's really fascinating, everybody, is that they weren't looking for these results. What they were trying to do was make an argument for using these barcodes to define what a species is, because they work so well. Because do you realize that you would think that we could define what a species is, right? I mean, surely we can do that now, right? No, there is no agreement as to what a species actually is. A simple definition used to be, well, if you could have these organisms reproduce an offspring that could reproduce. So, you know, we called a donkey and a horse different species, because even though they can make a mule, you know, the mules are sterile, right? So donkeys and horses were different species, but that's not even accepted as a definition anymore. So there's all kinds of controversy. What is a species? They were trying to propose that let's use these barcodes. And if two organisms have the same barcode, you know, if their barcode is identical, we don't care how different they look. We don't care where they live on the planet. They are the same species. That's the research they were doing. But when they finished, they determined this business where they found out that, oh no, all of these species have a common ancestor at the same point, and it's only, even by their estimates, 100,000 years ago. So this is the original paper. Human Evolution, Rockefeller Genetics Research Journal, I think it's called. And I want you to look at the top of the paper. See, it's just blank up there. It just says Human Evolution and the volume number. Well, since that publication in November, I think it was in June of 2018, and I took a quote from that UK article again. They published it on November 24th, which was a couple of months after the original research. And within 2 weeks, the editors of the Daily Mail, .UK News, were given an update. by the researchers. This is what they said. Since publication of this article, we have been contacted by Dr. Steckel and Thaler, that they were the original authors, who have made the following statement. Now listen to this. Our study is grounded in and strongly supports Darwinian evolution, including the understanding all life has evolved from a common biological origin over several billion years. Our study follows mainstream views of human evolution. We do not propose there was a single Adam or Eve. We do not propose any catastrophic events. And that now is at the top. If you go online and try to find their paper now, notice at the top of this, at the top of this paper up here, you will find this at the top of the paper. Remember in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy and the lion and those guys could look over and see the wizard, and he was saying, don't pay any attention to the man over in the corner. When you see something like this, it's like they're saying, don't pay any attention to the fact that everything that we've published actually appears to validate that there was an Adam and Eve and validate that there was a catastrophe and all of these organisms started over again off of the ark. It's comical, really, that to put in a statement like that at their paper, because it then just sends the flag that, oh, this is what this research actually means. So to show that this is even what they were thinking about, what they published there in that caveat sounds a lot different than what they published when they were doing some of the preliminary work in 2014. In that article, the authors assert that their findings can be explained by a global population crash and maybe even something similar to Noah's Ark. I'm just going to read the, this is their actual paper when they were starting this barcode studies. It says that don't worry about what the low ceiling means. But the low ceiling implies recent population crashes for all species. This appears unlikely, almost a Noah's Ark hypothesis. The idea that they would publish something like that is amazing. And I won't try to explain what the other part means. But now, as late as in January of last year, one of the authors has a blog. And this is something that he wrote in the blog. He wanted to get some discussion on this whole issue. A 648 base pair segment, that's that little piece of DNA that they call a barcode, known as a DNA barcode, has proven useful for species identification throughout the animal kingdom, which is what they were proposing they wanted to use the barcodes for. But then he goes on to say, despite their practical utility, in other words, they'll be really good to identify species, there are controversies concerning the uses and interpretation of DNA barcodes. And then what they wanted to do was have a open forum on the controversy of what actually this research sort of shows. Well, when you make these fantastic discoveries, and then because it actually shows that the Bible seems to be truer than evolution, you start backing away from it. It reminds me of something that Isaiah says in Isaiah 44. Look at this quote from Isaiah. I, the Lord and the maker of all things, stretching out the heavens by myself and spreading out the earth all alone, causing the omens of boasters to fail, making fools out of diviners, causing wise men to draw back, which is exactly what these researchers that did this great research did. I mean, they drew back. They just fell back because they couldn't stand what their research actually indicated, and turning their knowledge into foolishness. So I hope that you were able to grasp what they're doing with this genetic research, what they're discovering, and what it means. The bottom line is the most current research that is being done in genetics, far from challenging what the Bible says, is confirming the Bible to the extent that they're even talking about, oh no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. And you should be encouraged. You don't need to understand all this stuff to recognize that the Bible, no matter what it's talking about, is trustworthy. Science, history, and of course, most importantly, salvation, right? So thanks for paying attention. And I don't know if the 45 minutes are up. I don't know how long you actually had the Bible study, the presentation part. But if you want to take some time to ask some questions, I'm certainly willing to. Whoever is moderating the meeting, what do you think?
Sure. Yeah. If you want to ask a question, we can, you can unmute yourself and ask a question, or you can raise your hand and I'll unmute you.
Looks like Fred is raising his hand.
Yeah. Except he's gonna, so Fred, why don't you try hitting your, space bar there? Hit it one more. Hit it.
Does he have to hold it down or something? Because it's wiggling, but then it doesn't.
Just hit it once. All right. Yeah, hold it.
There you go. There you go.
Am I muted?
Yeah, no, we can hear you.
Good now.
Okay.
Now you're muted.
All right.
Here you go.
I don't have a screen that works. There's a virus in it here, Ben. I'd like you to investigate that. But it happened probably 30 minutes ago.
Oh, dear.
Not 600. But so I don't know whether I'm muted or not. I can't
see you.
You are. I understand you can see me. So I'm sorry about that. But Ben, this is all very interesting. Is there a publication from our side about these facts?
Yeah, yes. Let's see. I think the Creation Research Science, CRSQ, I think has an article talking about it. And I don't have it in front of me. I think Creation Matters also may have touched on it. I can give you the paper that Steckel and Thaler wrote, and you can read what they did. you can read the little disclaimer at the top of their paper. But what I could do is find those things and communicate back. And if you wanted to put that up somehow or make that CRSQ article available, but I'm sorry, I should have just had that in front of me, but I don't. Here's another one. Now this is a whole book. It doesn't get into as the DNA as much as it does the fossils. But this brother John Sanford is a geneticist, and he was a professor at Cornell, and he's a young Earth creationist and does a lot of work with genetics. And this book is newly published. It was published in 2017, and it's some of the newest material on both human evolution from the fossil perspective, and there is information in there about mitochondrial DNA. But even though this was published in 2017, the Steckel and Thaler paper hadn't even been published yet, so the final results won't be in this book. But this is called Contested Bones by Rupe, R-U-P-E, and Sanford. And this is excellent. This is the best book out there as far as being up to date on human evolution.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Hey, Fred, if you just get a few more viruses in your computer, and it keeps corrupting it, pretty soon you'll have a new program and maybe you'll be able to play a new video game. That's absurd, isn't it? That is what the evolutionists believe happens. DNA gets corrupted, it mutates, it keeps happening, and all of a sudden a new protein gets produced. Maybe a protein that'll help you and me eat bark, where we couldn't eat bark before, a new enzyme. They believe that happens. crazy.
So Barry Williams has a question.
Okay.
Ben, this may not totally relate to the teaching you've done tonight, but it does relate to RNA. I've heard that a proposed vaccine for COVID by being tested by Moderna is supposed to alter the person's RNA who receives the injection.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you think is true?
And, oh, yeah, it would be.
And if it is true, what does it do to, say, my RNA or anyone else's RNA? Is it a good thing, a bad thing?
Yeah, I think it would be a good thing. I mean, RNA is everywhere in your bodies. Like I pointed out, you have, never mind. Mitochondrial DNA is everywhere in your body. RNA is everywhere in your body. RNA is sort of like the go-between between DNA and your proteins. So RNA is everywhere. So they're not going to tamper with all your RNA. They are developing some kind of, whether it's an antibody or a drug, I would think it would be some kind of a monoclonal antibody that will attack the COVID-19 piece of RNA. You see, COVID-19 is not a piece of DNA. It's a virus made of RNA. All these viruses virtually that our bodies struggle with are RNA viruses. The common cold, the yearly flu that comes through every year, HIV, COVID, these are RNA viruses, and our bodies have a much more difficult time developing defenses against them because they rapidly mutate. So they change, and then your antibody doesn't recognize it anymore. So it'll be sort of this basic RNA structure that will mutate. The virus still has all of its properties. It still works, meaning it still infects you, but now your antibodies don't recognize it. So that's what's so difficult with RNA viruses. So this vaccine that they're coming up with is going to be something specifically directed at the genetic material of the COVID-19 virus. So that's definitely a good thing. And that's what it would have to be, an RNA, a vaccine against RNA, but not your RNA. It would be against the RNA of the virus, which is what it is.
Mm. Okay. Thank you.
Ben, this is Ray Giannini. I have a question. Actually, Shalita has a question for you. Shalita.
I guess in college we learned that DNAs are in the nucleus, not so. So there's DNA everywhere? I mean, mitochondria are outside the nucleus.
Correct. Yes.
How is that different?
Well, it's do you know what a mitochondria is? I'm just trying to, so I can answer your question. I don't know how far back I need to go with the information. Do you know what a mitochondrion is?
Yeah.
Okay. So every one of your cells have thousands of mitochondria in them because the mitochondria make ATP. They make the stuff that your chemical reactions run on.
Yes.
Well, a mitochondria has its own tiny little piece of DNA in it. So some of the proteins that it uses in its little structure, mm-hmm. it codes for itself. It can't completely replicate itself. It has to use the cellular apparatus as well. But some of the proteins that are in a mitochondria are encoded in its own little piece of DNA. So
So every protein has a DNA, sort of?
No.
Or just mitochondria?
Every protein is produced from a DNA. Gene that's made of DNA.
Yeah.
And almost all of them, those genes are in the nucleus.
Yes.
But there are a few proteins that are in the mitochondria that are produced from the DNA that's in the mitochondria.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
That's the only example of that in the normal human cell. Mm-hmm. Of course, what's going on with viruses, DNA viruses and RNA viruses, is that little piece of DNA comes from outside, gets in your cell, and starts making protein. Bad ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I see. Oh, wow.
But the proteins that the mitochondrial DNA make are good. They're part of the mitochondria, and we need mitochondria to survive.
Is it in the matrix part or the?
The mitochondria will be, they can be on the endoplasmic reticulum, the little membranes. Mm-hmm. They can float freely. They're all over the place because they're producing, I don't know if you know what ATP is.
Yes. But
ATP is the money of your cells. We might think that glucose is what we need for our energy. Well, yeah, but we can't really use glucose to run a chemical reaction. Mitochondria turn the glucose into ATP, and chemical reactions actually are run on ATP.
Yeah.
So, Ben, I was listening to a debate one time between Michael Behe and Intelligent Design, the professor that had written, Darwin's Black Box.
Yes.
And he related a story where there was a Chinese researcher and who gave a seminar in the U.S. And as he began to talk about the fossil record and the short time span that he thought all this occurred, an American professor got up and questioned him and said, "No, that doesn't fit into evolution." And that's when that Chinese professor said, "Maybe you know that. Do you want to tell the rest of that story?" Well, anyway, so So he said, in China, you can't question the government, but you can question, go where the science leads you. In the U.S., you can question the government, but you can't question evolution.
Yeah, it's that's a no-no. I mean, if you question evolution, you are censored. You might lose your job. It's truly amazing. And it's not like that in the rest of the world for the most part. I don't know if you ever saw a movie called Expelled. It's been out for a number of years now, yes. But what the movie was about is still totally valid. Ben Stein was interviewing a Polish professor, a guy from Poland. And they were talking about that, how, he was sort of commenting, you folks in America, you can't question evolution at all. In Europe, over here, we have a much more academic freedom to pursue where the research takes us, but not in the U.S. It's a bizarre reality. But actually, more and more, even evolutionary scientists are questioning Darwinism. It is getting to the point where, they're recognizing that it's unacceptable to assume that Darwinism can produce the genetic information necessary for all the variety of life that we've got and all the complex proteins that organisms contain. And so they're not saying that it's creation, but or even necessarily intelligent design, but they're thinking there's got to be some other explanation because Darwinism can't explain it. And thousands and thousands of scientists, and a lot of them aren't saying anything about it. Some of them will sign a statement that and remain anonymous because they're afraid for their job. They're afraid for their reputation.
Yes. What you share is very interesting, really insightful. Do you see any crack at all in this block of people who just wear blinders on and, just not only accept, Darwinian evolution, but global warming in the full sense of the word?
Yeah, radical environmentalism. Let's just lump it into even a larger group of people. Yeah, there is a crack. I don't see any crack developing in environmentalism, radical environmentalism. That is gaining more and more. That's where they're really camping, in an attempt to just control the minds of students and control our behaviors. Mm. Although this COVID-19 thing's working pretty good too. Anyway. Mm. There is a crack developing in Darwinism. Intelligent design is becoming more and more adhered to by lots of evolutionists even. Mm. They're recognizing that there's, now that they may think that the designer is some alien off in some other galaxy, you know, or somewhere, but they are recognizing that you can't, you know, the joke that I was playing with Fred there saying, oh, if he gets enough viruses in his computer, he'll get a new program that works really cool. You know, they recognize that it's ridiculous, that mm-hmm. it can't happen. Mm-hmm. We've never observed it. All we ever observe is the corruption of information leads to just disorder, mm-hmm. loss of information. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, Darwinism says that, oh, enough mutations accumulate and voila, you get new information mm-hmm. that can do new things. So there is a real crack in that.
Good.
Right now, I would say that as that is, maybe waning is too strong a word, but declining a little bit. Right now, radical environmentalism is definitely on the upswing.